This program is provided by lawyer Kyung Jin Kim.
So it's 1993, and we are sitting inside a Denny's diner in East San Jose.
Okay.
And, you know, the air just smells like cheap coffee and frying oil.
Oh, yeah, the classic diner smell.
Exactly. And huddled into one of those really sticky vinyl booths are three young electrical engineers. They're basically just leaning over the table, sketching out the architecture for a brand new technology company.
Right.
And one of them, a guy named Jensen Huang, is actually celebrating his 30th birthday.
Wow. 30th birthday at a Denny's.
Yeah. I mean, it is an incredibly mundane, humble starting point, right? But the kicker is that these three men have absolutely no idea that within just like 2 years of this diner breakfast, the dream they're sketching out is going to drag them to the absolute brink of destruction.
I love that, because that sensory detail, it completely shatters the Hollywood montage we usually associate with these massive tech empires.
Totally.
We tend to imagine this, you know, straight vertical line of unbridled genius and just uninterrupted success. And we completely ignore the brutal reality of how these companies are actually forged.
Which perfectly brings us to our mission for today's deep dive. We are exploring this fascinating stack of sources for you today. We've got a really detailed book chapter chronicling the early days of NVIDIA, an excerpt from Jensen Huang's 2023 Joe Rogan interview, and his highly unconventional 2024 Stanford commencement address.
Yeah, that speech was something else.
It really was.
Yep.
So we are going to unpack how a company that is currently a multi-trillion dollar titan, I mean, a company literally defining the future of artificial intelligence, how it was built entirely on a foundation of existential defeat.
Yeah, and the book chapter frames this beautifully, actually. It draws a historical parallel to ancient Rome.
Oh, right. The Battle of Cannae.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Hannibal had just completely annihilated the Roman army in what's considered one of the most crushing tactical defeats in military history.
Just a total bloodbath.
Total bloodbath. And the situation was so dire that the surviving politicians back in Rome were like packing their bags. They were screaming that the empire was over and they just needed to abandon the city.
Like complete capitulation.
Right. But then this young man named Scipio draws his sword, stands right in front of all these panicked politicians, and declares that anyone who abandons Rome is an enemy of Rome.
Wow.
He absolutely refuses to let the defeat be the final chapter.
Right.
And the central thesis of our sources today is that true history isn't actually written by the victors in their moment of triumph.
Right.
True empires are built entirely on how a leader behaves while standing in the ashes of utter failure.
I mean, let's apply that exact lens directly to NVIDIA's very first product in 1995. Because it is just a masterclass in catastrophic, almost fatal hubris.
Absolutely.
The product was called the NV1 chip, and the engineering team was so incredibly proud of it. On paper, it was an absolute monster.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a standard graphics card. It was like an everything machine.
Right. They really threw everything at it.
They did. It handled 3D graphics, 2D graphics, and audio processing all simultaneously. You didn't even need a separate sound card.
Which was huge back then.
Huge. They even engineered it so you could plug Sega Saturn game controllers directly into the board.
I mean, it was a wildly ambitious piece of hardware. But it contained this foundational, almost philosophical flaw.
Right.
Just a microscopic geometric choice that nearly drove the entire company into the ground.
The technical divergence here is so fascinating to me. At the time, there were two competing philosophies on how to render a 3D object onto a flat computer monitor.
Right, the rendering wars.
Exactly. So the first method involved connecting just countless tiny triangles together.
Yeah.
If you use enough flat triangles, you can approximate the shape of pretty much anything, you know, like a landscape, a car, a building.
And then the second method used quadrilaterals, basically squares.
Right.
And NVIDIA chose to bet the entire company on the quadrilateral.
Wow.
Because mathematically, squares are actually theoretically better at rendering organic smooth curves.
Okay, so if you want to draw a perfect sphere, or like the soft curve of a human cheekbone, quadrilaterals give you a much more aesthetically pleasing result than triangles.
Exactly.
But wait, if the quadrilateral approach actually produced better looking organic shapes and superior visual curves, why didn't Jensen just, you know, dig his heels in? Like, why not fight to make squares the industry standard if it was genuinely visually superior?
Well, because mathematical elegance rarely wins a war against standardization. Triangles have a massive computational advantage. They are always coplanar.
Meaning they're flat?
Exactly. A triangle is, by definition, perfectly flat. Quadrilaterals can warp and twist in three-dimensional space, which requires significantly more complex math for the hardware to process.
Oh, I see.
But more importantly, the market was about to basically dictate the rules. Microsoft had just released Windows 95.
Which fundamentally reorganized the whole computing world.
Right. And bundled with Windows 95 was a software toolkit called DirectX.
And this was essentially the universal toolkit handed out to every single game developer on Earth.
Yep. Exactly. Microsoft essentially weaponized convenience here. They told developers, hey, if you build your game using DirectX, we guarantee it will work flawlessly on any Windows 95 computer.
Oh, wow.
But Microsoft made a definitive line-in-the-sand choice. DirectX only supported triangles.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It structurally rejected quadrilaterals. So overnight, Microsoft dictates the language of 3D graphics. And they chose the exact language NVIDIA explicitly didn't speak.
So NVIDIA essentially built the world's most luxurious aerodynamic electric car. Like, they obsessed over the leather seats and the acceleration.
Right.
But right as they roll it out of the factory, the government mandates a triangle-shaped charging plug, and their car only accepts a square plug.
That captures the isolation perfectly. NVIDIA became an island. If a software developer wanted to use NVIDIA's NV1 card, they basically had to bypass DirectX completely.
Which nobody wanted to do.
Right. They'd have to write incredibly complex custom code just for that specific chip. And the market simply refused to do it.
The fallout described in the text is just suffocating. I mean, aside from a couple of Sega arcade ports like Panzer Dragoon and Virtua Fighter, the ecosystem just ignored them.
Yeah.
The chips just sat in warehouses gathering dust, revenue flatlines. They had to gut their staff, bleeding talent, until they went from dozens of these highly specialized engineers
right
down to a skeleton crew of about 30 people.
Just 30 people left.
Yeah. Jensen was a 32-year-old CEO waking up every single morning, genuinely wondering if the office doors would be padlocked by the end of the week.
He is standing in the ruins of his own strategy. I mean, this is his Battle of Cannae. The technology he bet his life on was functionally obsolete the moment it arrived.
But just as the company is suffocating, this massive, almost movie script lifeline materializes. Sega approaches NVIDIA.
Yeah, talk about timing.
Right. Sega is actively developing a brand new game console, the Dreamcast, to wage war against Sony's PlayStation. And they desperately need a cutting-edge graphics chip, which they codenamed the NV2. So Sega offers NVIDIA a $5 million contract to build it.
And for a company operating with 30 employees and the Bureau of Revenue, $5 million isn't just a contract, it's oxygen.
It guarantees survival.
Right.
Here is the trap, though. As Jensen starts scoping out this NV2 project, he realizes Sega is demanding that the chip be built using that exact quadrilateral technology.
Right, because Sega had this massive legacy of arcade hardware, and their internal logic was heavily biased toward their own proprietary methods. They really wanted to stick with squares.
But Jensen now understands the gravity of the DirectX monopoly. Like, he knows the war is over and triangles won.
Yeah.
He realizes that if NVIDIA fulfills this contract and builds a square-based chip for the Dreamcast, the console will be entirely incompatible with the broader ecosystem of PC developers.
Which means nobody will port their games to the Dreamcast.
Exactly. The console will inevitably fail, and it will just drag NVIDIA right into the grave alongside it.
It forces this brutal CEO paradox.
Hmm.
You know, you take the $5 million today, fulfill the contract, and essentially guarantee the slow death of both companies.
Right.
Or you refuse the contract, receive $0, and bankrupt your own company by the end of the day.
So Jensen chooses to get on a plane to Tokyo. He secures a face-to-face meeting with Sega's CEO, Shoichiro Irimajiri.
And Irimajiri is not your traditional executive.
No, he is a legendary former Honda engineer. He built his reputation designing these wildly innovative, high-revving motorcycle engines. He is a total engineering purist.
I mean, the psychological tension in that meeting room must have been unimaginable. Jensen is holding a completely losing hand,
yeah,
sitting across from a titan of industry.
And Jensen makes this radically honest plea that just defies every instinct of corporate survival. I mean, a normal executive would smile, hide the architectural flaws, take the $5 million to buy a year of runway.
Yeah, of course.
And try to quietly fix the mess later, right?
That's what you'd expect.
But instead, Jensen looks at Irimajiri and explicitly says, "The technology we promised you is wrong." He actually actively advises Sega to find another manufacturing partner.
Wow.
He warns them that Microsoft's Triangle Standard will sink the Dreamcast if they proceed with NVIDIA's design.
So he is effectively firing himself, incinerating his only lifeline in the process.
He does, but then he follows it up with this impossibly audacious request.
Yeah, this is the best part.
He tells Iramajiri, "We are broke. If we walk away from this, we evaporate today. So please, let us keep the $5 million you promised us, even though we aren't building your chip, so we can pivot to the right technology and survive."
I mean, asking to be fully compensated for breaching your own contract is just staggering.
It's insane. And Iramajiri says yes. He actually lets them keep the money.
And to understand why he said yes,
yeah,
you really have to look at the psychology of investment. Iramajiri was an engineer who took massive perilous risks in his own youth.
Right.
So when he looked across the table at this desperate 32-year-old CEO, he recognized a profoundly rare trait, absolute intellectual honesty.
Wow.
Jensen was prioritizing the customer's ultimate survival over his own company's immediate financial preservation. Iramajiri realized the underlying architecture was flawed, but the character of the founder was not.
So he was investing in the person.
Exactly. He invested $5 million in Jensen Huang's integrity, knowing that a leader who possesses that level of desperate honesty will eventually figure out the engineering.
So Jensen flies back to California with his $5 million and a second chance. But we need to contextualize that money. In the semiconductor industry, $5 million is pocket change.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't fund the multi-year development cycle.
Oh.
Which brings us to the immense hurdle of the tape-out.
Right. Explain the tape-out process.
So a tape-out is the final agonizing phase of semiconductor design. It's the moment you take your digital blueprints and send them off to a fabrication plant to be physically etched into silicon.
And historically, this is an incredibly iterative process, right? Like, you physically print a test chip, plug it into a motherboard, discover a dozen hardware bugs, revise the blueprints, and print another test chip.
Exactly. And each physical tape-out costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. Companies usually do several. But NVIDIA only had enough capital for a single tape-out.
Just one.
One bullet in the chamber.
Yeah.
If there was a single microscopic flaw in the physical architecture, the remaining capital would be gone and NVIDIA would cease to exist.
So Jensen takes half of their remaining lifeline and spends it on a massive experimental piece of software called an emulator.
Which was completely revolutionary at the time. Instead of printing physical silicon to test their work, they built a simulated computer environment.
Okay.
They essentially created a virtual reality testing ground where they could run software drivers against a digital ghost of a chip that didn't physically exist yet.
Wait, that sounds like, that's like designing a brand new commercial airliner entirely on a computer, skipping all the wind tunnel and unmanned flight tests, and loading it up with paying passengers for its very first physical takeoff.
I mean, it was considered absolute madness. The industry orthodoxy dictated that you never go straight to mass production without physical prototype testing.
Yeah.
But they just didn't have the luxury of orthodoxy.
They didn't have the time or the money. The source material details this insane 7-month sprint. Jensen contacted Morris Chang, the founder of TSMC, the massive Taiwanese chip manufacturer, and convinced him to mass produce this new chip based purely on their software simulations.
Incredible.
Everyone at NVIDIA worked through the night, month after month. Jensen's constant rallying cry to the team was simply, "We only have 30 days left."
And against all odds, the gamble held. In 1997, they released the RYVI 128 chip.
And it was an absolute triumph. It flawlessly supported the Microsoft DirectX Triangle Standard. It undercut the dominant competitor, 3DFXX, on price, while vastly exceeding them in processing speed.
Yeah.
Game developers flocked to it, and they sold 1 million units in just 4 months. NVIDIA went from the brink of bankruptcy to completely dominating the global market.
Now, you would assume that pulling off an engineering miracle of that magnitude, you know, securing the future of the company, would allow a founder to finally exhale.
To finally sleep at night.
To step back and enjoy the victory, right. But instead, the sheer terror of 1996 permanently rewired Jensen's brain.
It actually became the cultural DNA of the entire organization. NVIDIA adopted this unofficial corporate motto, "We are always 30 days from bankruptcy."
Which sounds like, you know, a hyper-aggressive startup slogan printed on a poster.
Yeah.
But for NVIDIA, it is a genuine operating philosophy.
Really?
Yeah. The Joe Rogan interview source really illuminates this. Rogan asked Jensen about his daily routine now that he runs a company valued at over $3 trillion.
Right, because you'd think he's just relaxing on a yacht somewhere.
Exactly. But Jensen admits that even after three decades, The visceral feeling of vulnerability and anxiety has literally never faded.
He wakes up at 4 a.m. every single morning. He processes thousands of emails. He works 7 days a week, pushing straight through holidays. He described it as a constant, exhausting state of anxiety, like he deliberately refuses to feel safe.
And this connects directly back to the Roman analogy. When victorious Roman generals would parade through the streets of Rome, soaking in the adulation of the crowds, a slave was assigned to stand directly behind the general and whisper a single phrase in his ear.
Memento mori.
Exactly. Remember death.
Remember that you are mortal.
Precisely. 30 days from bankruptcy is Jensen Huang's daily memento mori. It is a psychological safeguard explicitly designed to prevent the fatal arrogance that birthed the NV1 disaster in the first place.
So he is artificially keeping the trauma alive. And that philosophy takes center stage in the 2024 Stanford commencement address. Jensen is standing at a podium, looking out at a sea of brilliant, hyper-ambitious graduates who are fully expecting an uplifting speech about chasing their dreams. Instead, he looks at them and says, "With complete sincerity, I wish upon you ample doses of pain and suffering."
It's a totally jarring message for a graduation ceremony.
Yeah.
But it is rooted in a profound psychological insight. Jensen articulates a direct correlation between expectation and resilience.
Okay, unpack that.
He argues that graduates from elite institutions naturally harbor sky-high expectations for their careers. But high expectations generally produce incredibly low resilience. When the inevitable failure arrives, they just shatter.
Because they've never built the calluses.
Exactly. And low resilience breeds perpetual unhappiness.
Jensen's thesis is that going through immense professional pain like surviving a near-death corporate experience forcibly lowers your baseline expectations.
Right.
It makes you profoundly grateful merely to survive. It forces you to appreciate the incremental wins. And that deep-seated trauma-forged gratitude is the actual engine of enduring success. And NVIDIA institutionalized that exact philosophy through a core cultural pillar they call intellectual honesty. Because in standard corporate environments, failure is fiercely punished.
Oh, absolutely.
If an executive makes a disastrous bet, their first instinct is to obfuscate, shift the blame to another department, and just get highly defensive.
Right. Defensiveness is the natural shield of the ego.
But at NVIDIA, employees are actively required to present their failures openly in front of their peers. They literally stand up and clearly state, "I made this hypothesis, it was completely incorrect, and here is exactly why the project failed."
Wow.
One of the veteran employees quoted in our sources even noted that if someone starts getting defensive or deflecting blame during a postmortem meeting, everyone in the room immediately knows that person won't last long at the company.
Because Jensen learned in that Tokyo boardroom with Sega that hiding a mistake will literally kill the organization.
Yeah.
Embracing the vulnerability of failure allows the collective intelligence of the company to instantly course correct.
Yeah.
Ego is just a fatal luxury when your operational mindset is perpetually 30 days from insolvency.
It is entirely wild to think about a multi-trillion dollar global juggernaut operating with the desperate, cornered mentality of a garage startup. Mm. And we really have to recognize what this agonizing trial by fire ultimately produced.
Right.
Because surviving the RYVE 128 gamble didn't just save a graphics card manufacturer. It inadvertently laid the hardware foundation for the modern world. In 1999, 2 years after emerging from the ashes, NVIDIA coined a brand new term, the GPU, or graphics processing unit.
And at the time, the broader tech industry completely dismissed it as just clever marketing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they thought NVIDIA was just trying to dress up a component that made video game explosions look slightly more realistic.
But because of the immense engineering crucible they had just survived, I mean, the relentless optimization required to process millions of triangles simultaneously, they realized they hadn't just built a gaming peripheral. They had forged an entirely new type of digital architecture. While the traditional CPU processes tasks sequentially, like one after another, the GPU they developed could process thousands of complex mathematical operations simultaneously in parallel.
And parallel processing is the exact computational bedrock required to train large language models. The entire generative AI revolution we're living through right now is running on the descendant architecture of a company that only learned how to build it because they were terrified of going extinct.
They had to walk through the fire just to understand how to harness the heat. I mean, it is an incredible trajectory from that sticky Denny's table to the absolute center of the global economy.
It really is.
Which leaves us with a final thought I want you to mull over today. Take a moment and look at the most significant professional failure or the deepest source of career pain in your life right now. The exact thing you instinctively want to hide or defend yourself against. What if that failure isn't the final chapter of your story? What if it is the precise dose of pain and suffering required to shatter your hubris, build your resilience, and lay the unshakable foundation for your own ultimate breakthrough?
The wrong bet, honestly acknowledged, is often the exact tuition required to finally understand the game.
Keep that in mind the next time you feel like you are 30 days from bankruptcy. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.
This program is provided by Lawyer Kyungjin Kim.